This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In Fanfare Cincinnati for March of 2022, Jonathan Kramer explains the events behind Béla Bartók's composition of the Third Piano Concerto. When Bartók toured the United States in 1927, he visited Cincinnati to rehearse the American premiere of his first piano concerto with conductor Fritz Reiner. As he knew little English and had few acquaintances in town, it was natural that he spent most of his free time with Thibaut Serly, a composer who played in the orchestra's viola section. Serly had met Bartók 4 years earlier while studying in Hungary. When Bartók moved permanently to the United States several years later, Serly again came into his life. The violist had moved to New York to play in the NBC Symphony. He met the Bartóks' boat in 1940 and remained close to the composer for the remaining years of his life. Those were difficult years. Bartók desperately missed his homeland, but he was unable to return because of the war. He had little money, and he and his wife were forced to live in a cramped apartment in New York. His health was failing, and he could no longer perform as a pianist. The composer was eager to receive commissions that might provide much-needed income. He was no doubt pleased to receive no fewer than 4 commissions in the first months of 1945, but his health was too precarious for him to accept them all. When the summer came and Bartók was able to leave his tiny apartment for a holiday at Saranac Lake, Bartók planned to work on the viola concerto for William Primrose, and surprisingly, on a non-commissioned work. Bartók's publisher had requested the Third Piano Concerto back in 1940, but the composer had not written it. Now he wanted to undertake it in addition to the viola concerto. Thibaut Serly explained, "In America, Bartók's main source of a steady income had been through lecture and concert engagements, but for 2 years he had been too ill to take on either, and now he feared he might never be well enough to return to the concert stage. He considered his talented wife and former pupil, Gita Pastori Bartók, to be among his most representative disciples and greatly admired her interpretation of his piano works. Sensing the seriousness of his illness, Bartók determined to leave her the only inheritance within his power, a concerto for piano and orchestra made to order for her style, a work that would give her an opportunity both to exhibit her talents and at the same time carry on as a disciple of the Bartók tradition." Bartók worked hard, as his health would permit, on both concertos throughout the summer. When he returned to New York in September, the viola concerto was still in a fragmentary state. The piano concerto was completely sketched, and much of the orchestration had been accomplished. On September 21st, Serly visited the composer in the small apartment. "He was obviously quite ill. By that time it was very well known that he was close to having completed the viola concerto for Mr. Primrose, but strangely a totally different manuscript was in his lap. This was the third piano concerto. I had some vague notion that he had been writing a piano concerto, but no one else knew about it. The very morning after Surly's visit, Bartok was taken to the hospital. He died 5 days later, having completed all but the final 17 measures of the piano concerto's orchestration. Surly himself later undertook filling in the orchestration in the final bars. In the BBC Music Magazine for September of 2023, we get to interview up-and-coming violinist Geneva Lewis. Where were you born? Auckland, New Zealand. What would be your career highlights so far? Performing with the Auckland Philharmonia in February. It was my first time home since 2005, and it was incredibly moving to return to my country. Who are your musical heroes? Three teachers: Miriam Freet for inspiring an endless fascination with sounds and for making music with my whole heart and head. Aimé Creston for encouraging me to follow my intuition. And Mihaela Martin for teaching me always to keep searching. What would be your dream concert? Sharing the stage with musicians I love and admire. Collaboration has always been one of my favorite aspects of music making. In the BBC Music Magazine for November of 2023, Rebecca Franks tells us about the Welsh National Opera performance in the annual Prague Spring Festival. It's a warm May evening in Prague. People dressed in black tie flock to the Smetana Hall, a beautiful Art Nouveau building in the center of the city. The 1,200-seat auditorium is full. The TV cameras are rolling, the radio mics are broadcasting, and eager concertgoers are snapping selfies. A brass fanfare heralds the arrival of Czech President Peter Pavel, and after the orchestra plays the national anthem, the concert begins. 80 minutes or so later, after a fluid and vivid performance of Smetana's Vma Vlast, the last note falls silent. The hall fills with applause. Everyone, including the president, gets to their feet. It's clear that this first concert of the 2023's Prague Spring Festival, arguably the most prestigious date in the Czech Republic's classical musical calendar, has been a success. And who was playing? None other than the orchestra of Welsh National Opera, WNO. It was a milestone moment for this ensemble, not only because, like all opera orchestras, it's probably more often heard than seen by audiences. Sitting out of sight in the orchestra pit, it's nonetheless the musical bedrock of WNO, playing everything from Verdi to Janáček to Elena Langer, even though the WNO orchestra is no stranger to giving standalone concerts in its home city of Cardiff. This rare international appearance was a big deal. It's only the fourth time a British orchestra has appeared at the Prague Spring Festival. Even more notable, it's the first time an opera orchestra has ever opened the event, with WNO's band joining a lineup of the world's finest symphony orchestras. Next year, the honor goes to the Berlin Philharmonic and its conductor, Kirill Petrenko. The gig, and the repeat concert the next day, came about after WNO's conductor, Tomáš Hanus, was invited to Prague. Although he is a leading Czech conductor, it was a good decade since he had performed at this annual festival.
I vividly remember Yuri Bohalavik saying we should invite Tomáš in something like 2015, explains Pavel Trohan, the sparky new director of the festival, over coffee the next day after the concert. After 8 years, we succeeded. The artistic board listened to the tremendous music from WNO and wanted to invite them. The WNO instrumentalists added Smetana's Mavlast to their music stands to rehearse alongside their spring schedule of Mozart's The Magic Flute and their latest new commission, Blaze of Glory, and prepared to pack their bags for the Czech Republic. This is the greatest concert that a Czech conductor could dream of, Hannes tells me over Zoom, just after the orchestra's last UK rehearsal. The opening concert has huge symbolic power. The first night always takes place on the 12th of May, the birthday of Bedřich Smetana, often considered the father of Czech music. And Mavlast, or My Country, has been the only piece programmed since 1952, a tradition initiated 6 years after the Prague Spring Festival was founded by conductor Rafael Kubilich. It's music that has held long a special place in the Czech imagination. The six symphonic poems, of which the second, portraying the great river Vltava, is the most famous, were written between 1874 and 79, helping to strengthen nationalistic feeling among people who were still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Together, the pieces draw inspiration from Bohemian mythology, legend, history, and landscape. Mavlast is not a triumphalist piece that superficially celebrates the country's history, explains Hannes. It touches some very painful moments, but it also helps keep the good parts inside of us alive. So, what does an opera orchestra bring to a symphonic masterpiece? Through opera, we have a particular way of playing, reflects David Adams, leader of the WNO orchestra. It isn't like a normal symphony orchestra. I think we respond in a slightly different way. It's too simplistic to say it's more like chamber music, but it is a bit like that. And one of the many things about Tomáš's interpretation of Mavlast is that it's very flexible.
Certainly there's this phenomenon of a special flexibility because with opera you never know what will happen. Because it's so complex, you have to be prepared for everything, says Hannes. I think that gives a conductor a feeling of great possibility. You can really go for a musical moment, or wait, or go for a special phrasing or a sound. And in a way, the WNO orchestra is easy to conduct because they respond so well. For the WNO orchestra, this international trip couldn't be more timely. Last year, Arts Council England cut 35% from WNO's grant. As an immediate consequence, the company had to withdraw Liverpool from its touring circuit. Appearing in Prague is a boost. I think it shows us how people over there appreciate the quality of WNO. And I would love this to be a great inspiration for the UK to appreciate this orchestra too, says Hannes. The last few months have been very difficult, very worrying, and we're concerned about the future. So to have this week is an amazing thing for us. It gives us belief we can really do this, and we have something wonderful to offer. We would like everyone to shout about it. A month later, a letter to the Times, signed by names including soprano Dame Kiri Tikhanova, Arts Administrator Sir Brian McMaster and Director Sir David Pountney did just that. A column in the same newspaper by Richard Morrison revealed that transition money had been offered by ACE if WNO reduces its orchestra by a quarter and a chorus by a third. Talking before the concert and before that letter was published, Adams agrees the orchestra should be valued. "We've always done some concerts, but we're an opera orchestra, so for us to be given a platform is a massive thing. It feels significant and a testament to the way we work and what we can offer." If this concert has been a vital showcase for the WNO Orchestra, it also represents decades of a strong artistic connection between the Welsh company and the Czech nation. Of course, that fits into a wider UK picture. When the Prague Spring Festival first flung its doors wide to orchestras from abroad in 1993, following the collapse of the Soviet Union and dissolution of Czechoslovakia, the first international visitors were from Britain, with Czech conductor Libor Pišek bringing over his Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra to play Mavlast. In the other direction, Jiří Bělohlávek spent 6 years at the BBC Symphony Orchestra, while fellow countryman Jakub Hrucha is set to take over as music director at the Royal Opera House in London in 2025, joining Hanusz in the lineup of Czech artists at the helm of major UK opera institutions. Hanusz, who was born in Brno, the hometown of Janáček, joined WNO in 2016, and Janáček's operas have been a staple of his seasons ever since, beginning with a brilliant revival of From the House of the Dead, and last year featuring a 5-star The Micropolis Affair. Both productions transferred to the Janáček Brno Festival. "We did 2 performances on the recent trip. A concert on one night and an opera the next. The audiences were amazing," says Adams. "And equally, when we did House of the Dead 4 years ago, we felt a real buzz. We've worked with Tomáš on this repertoire and feel increasingly confident about how we should go about it." While Hanus is the first Czech music director in Cardiff, WNO's Czech tradition stretches back decades. Pountney, who was WNO's director from 2011 to 19, staged a landmark cycle of 5 Janáček operas in collaboration with Scottish Opera at WNO in the 1970s. It was his From the House of the Dead production that was revived in 2017. And from 1987 to 92, WNO's music director was conductor Sir Charles McHarris, who studied in Prague in the 1940s, discovered a little-known composer called Janáček, and championed him around the world. "There's definitely a certain acknowledgement of that tradition," says Adams. "There are some players who played Janáček in the 1990s with McGarris, and for those of us who didn't, we're still aware the music has been part of WNO for years. I don't know why that makes a difference, but it does give you a certain responsibility." And it's not only in the UK that the advocacy of McGarris and Pountney has an impact. It made a difference back in the Czech Republic. "Many Czech composers had to become famous elsewhere to be accepted in our country," says Trohan. "It happened with Dvořák, whose symphonies and oratorios had huge success in London, with Smetana, with Martinu, and I think especially with Janáček, for whom the UK and personalities like Charles McHarris and David Pountney
were successful in promoting his music. Smetana's Mavlast doesn't need any help nowadays, but there's something satisfying about knowing that back in 1983, Mikaris conducted the complete piece with the WNO Orchestra in Cardiff. Since then, the exchange has continued. When Hanush and his musicians performed it in St. David's Hall in the same city 40 years later this January, Czech journalists traveled to cover it. The orchestra's appearance in Prague is far from a novelty and a one-off. It's part of an ongoing conversation. And that, says Hanus, is important.
People throughout history have cried with Smetana is my country. There were many Czech people who were forced to stay abroad, and so many people who heard the piece being stolen from its roots by the totalitarian system, says Hanus. This is the experience of Middle Europe, while the UK has had relative freedom. I think these two experiences need to be in dialogue. The freedom and the experience of oppression and exile. That's why I'm so happy a British orchestra is doing this concert.
In the July 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Terry Blaine describes the near suicide of Beethoven's nephew Karl. On the 29th of July, 1826, a young man climbed up to the hillside ruins of Castle Rauenstein in Baden, a spa town 20 miles south of Vienna. Arriving at his destination, he drew two pistols from his pocket. Aiming one at his head, he pulled the trigger, but the bullet either missed or misfired in the chamber. The second pistol, however, partially found its target. The bullet gouged the left-hand side of the shooter's skull without entering the brain, leaving him slumped and barely conscious. Who was the unfortunate individual? It soon emerged his name was Karl von Beethoven, nephew of the famed composer Ludwig, and that his attempted suicide was anything but a spur-of-the-moment decision. Just days earlier, Karl's landlord, Schlemmer, had warned Beethoven that the 19-year-old intended to shoot himself next Sunday at the latest. Schlemmer found two pistols in Karl's room. But Karl had pawned his watch to buy replacements. What pushed him to such a desperate situation? Karl himself had no doubt what had caused it. His uncle Ludwig had tormented him too much, he told police investigating the incident. I became worse because my uncle wanted me to be better. Posterity has tended to agree with the unfortunate Karl's analysis. Beethoven's fraught involvement with his nephew began 11 years earlier when the composer's younger brother Caspar died, leaving behind his wife Johanna and 9-year-old Karl. Caspar's will originally made both Johanna and Beethoven Karl's guardians. But Johanna's name was subsequently deleted, seemingly at Beethoven's insistence. I did not wish to be bound up with such a bad woman in a matter of such importance as the education of the child, he wrote. What exactly was bad about Johanna? Her conviction for embezzlement in 1811, after purloining a set of pearls that she was selling on consignment, was one notorious mark against her. Johanna was also, Beethoven believed, an adulteress, perhaps a prostitute who had killed her husband by poisoning. Caspar actually died from consumption. Morally outraged, he vowed to wrest a poor, unhappy child from the clutches of a vicious, bestial mother. Beethoven's jaundiced view of Johanna was unquestionably exaggerated. An obsession bordering on the insane, one commentator has called it. She herself lived in a toxic relationship with an abusive husband who allegedly once pinned her hand with a knife to the dinner table. Caspar also beat his son, and likely Johanna too. Beethoven knew about the turmoil and wanted to remove Karl from any further possibility of domestic upset. Instead, he achieved exactly the opposite. 5 years of legal wrangling for the custody of his nephew followed, which only traumatized Karl further. Beethoven repeatedly tried to stop the boy seeing his mother and exerted an iron control over his education. Unsurprisingly, Karl reacted badly, fleeing Beethoven's home, stealing money, and at one point even striking his uncle. By July 1826, Beethoven's stifling protectiveness had pushed Karl to breaking point. His attempted suicide at Castle Rauenstein was, however, a turning point of sorts. On recovery, he joined the army, married, and fathered 5 children. When Beethoven died in 1827, he left everything to Karl, making him financially comfortable for the future. In truth, Beethoven had never stopped loving the nephew he called my son. He dreamed of shaping a young man to be proud of, one to fill the void of loneliness that Beethoven's own failure to build lasting emotional relationships had created. But as one Beethoven biographer has put it, he never realized that a child cannot be shaped like a piece of music. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.